Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Today we're diving deep into the findings of the recent wake-up call, the 2022 National Health and Morbidity Survey on Adolescent Health. The survey has brought to light a worrisome decline in the health and lifestyle habits of Malaysian teenagers. From rising obesity rates to alarming sedentary behaviours, the numbers speak volumes about the state of adolescent health. Now, in this episode, we will dissect why public policy attention to adolescent health is no longer just an option, but an urgent necessity. So joining me on the show, I have Associate Professor Dr. Nur Azima Muhammad. She's a consultant in family medicine and a senior lecturer at the Department of Family Medicine at UKM's Faculty of Medicine. Dr. Nur Azima, thank you for joining me on the show today. That period of adolescence, as I understand it, is one of transition from adulthood, childhood to adulthood, and a period that comes with many rapid changes in your body, your physical, your cognitive, your emotions. Can you help us better understand, though, Dr. Azima, why it is that adolescent health is important from a public health perspective?
Right. First of all, thanks, Melissa, and Astro for inviting me to share my view on this. Well, definitely adolescent is very important to start with. They are our future adults. They are future, our future leaders. They are our future generation, as simple as that. Therefore, we need to set the platform right. We need them to practice a healthy lifestyle so that we have healthy generations in the future. And people are talking about transgenerational lifestyle. So if parents practice unhealthy lifestyle, more likely the children would also practice the same. Therefore, we need to do something in order to stop and to have healthy generation in the future.
Right. Okay. So transgeneration lifestyle is interesting. I'm going to come back to that. But I also wanted to ask you, part of understanding adolescent health is the need for good data to understand kind of population trends. Surveys like the NHMS, the National Health and Morbidity Survey, that really brought quite a lot of attention to the lifestyle of Malaysian teenagers. Why are surveys like that important? How do you, as a practitioner, as a researcher, how do you use data from those types of surveys to inform your work?
Right. I think from the recent NHMS data in year 2020 that you just mentioned, the six element that if you look at the shortcuts from the Ministry of Health, if we talk about obesity and overweight, one in three of our youngsters having a weight problem, that is number one. If we talk about cigarette, 10%, one in 10 are actually smoke a cigarette or e-cigarette as young as below 14 years old, 60% of them. And if we look into the use of drug, less than 5%. If we look into alcohol, 10%. And another important issue is the lifestyle also include the premarital sex. And if we go deeper, perhaps there's a move towards homosexuality and so forth. So that constitutes about 7.3%. So how do, and of course the number six, I think that has been highlighted in the data is the amount of hours that our youngsters spend online. And in that report, about 90%, 85.7%. So how do to answer you, Melissa, how do I use this? It is a high time for us to do something to promote a healthier lifestyle, to make the parents to begin with, to, this is a wake-up call to everyone. We have to sort of bring this to the attention of all the people, not only the adolescent, but the parents need to take action as well. If we talk about obesity, how does a person become obese? Of course, genetic has a play in that, but largely it is contributed by what we eat, what we put on our plate, and how do we lead our activities, 24 hours activities. And if we talk about adolescent, if you look at our adolescent or perhaps our school children activities, how many hours that they spend to do physical activities in reality? So for a normal child, for a normal teens, they go to school from perhaps 7 to 2 or 3. Then what do? After that, some of them may go to extra classes. Then at night, they'll be doing their schoolwork, right? So when is the time for them to do physical activity? Similarly, what do they have on their plate for their breakfast, for their lunch, and for their dinner? So that's why I said family is very important. Parents, awareness is important. It's a big issue now that parents need to play a part. What do they put on the plate? Similarly, the school, what they prepare in the school canteen. That is just when we talk about obesity, and I can go to talk about sexuality and whatnot.
Yes. Let's focus on the dietary behavior and physical activity first. There are a couple of threads that that I want to pull at. The first is, let's focus on the trend. Has it been is this a declining trend? Because I'm wondering,
for years past?
Yes, it has been ongoing, I would say static or actually increasing instead of declining in terms of the prevalence of overweight and obesity. I mean, I've been doing the work involving children with status, so there's not much change or improvement in terms of the prevalence. So it's just basically 1 in 3 is still high, 30%. And we know that as this adolescent, if they are having this weight status problem during adolescence, they're more likely to persist during adulthood. And we know that in our country, the number of non-communicable diseases such as diabetes is very prevalent. So we need to do something to stop it.
Right. The other thing that you mentioned was about transgenerational lifestyles, right? So the lifestyle of the parent will, the dietary behaviors of the parent will likely transcend to the offspring. Can I ask you about that? Because a full-grown adult is not the same as a young adolescent in the need for in physiology and in dietary requirements. But if in the household, the parent is thinking like an adult, and rather than to catering to the dietary requirements of child and adolescents, how do we think about that? The portion sizes, the type of food that's needed, all of that is kind of important in a household. So a parent might eat a full plate of nasi because they're working manual labor, but a child, as you said, going to school and has sedentary lifestyle may not necessarily have the same kind of caloric requirements.
Yeah. Well, I suppose in general, I think Malaysian in terms of the working environment and the sort of working scenario in Malaysia, I think we are more of office work. Or perhaps we work in... We don't really use much energy in our adult population, I think. So in terms of, I just would like to correct, I think it's quite incorrect if we say the adults need to have a higher portion compared to the adolescent. I would still recommend the same pinggan suku-suku separuh. You've heard the Ministry of Health campaigned about healthy plate. the pinggan suku-suku separuh where half of the portion should be vegetables and fruits and quarter for the carbohydrate. It can be bread or rice. Of course, in Malaysia, we have rice. And another quarter is for the protein. And I still believe this pinggan suku-suku separuh is applicable for the adult as well as the teens, as well as the adolescent. So this is the concept that we need to make parents aware. Mm. And they need to sort of have the same amount. So then the teens would actually follow whatever that the parents are doing. Of course, if we are talking about young children, then perhaps there's extra nutrition that they need. But in general, I still believe the pinggan suku-suku separuh is still applicable to most population in general.
Right. Dr. Azima, you also pointed out to the lack of physical activity in an average teenager's life, given school and extracurricular activities and all that. Is there a way to introduce more physical activity? Are our school lives structured in a way that doesn't lend itself to creating healthy teenagers?
If you ask me, if I have the power, I would like to recommend just half an hour before they start the class, do a simple physical exercise before they start the class every day. And perhaps people would say it's impossible because they're in the school uniform. Then why don't we change that? Make the kids go to school in tees and track bottom so that they can be active. And only certain day that, I mean, one day a week, there will be in formal attire. Other than that, they'll be in a dress code where would allow them to be active. And the material, I mean, the tea material, like you, apa, serap peluh. So that kind of making it feasible for them, what we need to do is we need to be creative enough to use whatever means to integrate the healthy lifestyle in our daily life. That's the campaign. Well, I'm not talking about having extra module, extra curriculum. It's just that half an hour every day before they start the class, because it's still but not very hot, so the that kind of weather perhaps more suitable for the kids to be active, for the teens to be active. Just do that every day, because then the environment is so supportive to be active.
We're so lucky to have this kind of this weather that allows for us to be active. It really is a shame that we're spending it all indoors and not utilizing it. Let's
move the conversation
to vitamin D.
Vitamin D also, definitely. I also wanted to touch on the other portion of the National Health and Mobility Survey about sexual reproductive health, particularly among teens. It was found that one third of sexually experienced teenagers had had sex before the age of 14. I think that was what had caught the attention of a lot of the news headlines. In your line of work, how do you think about teenagers who are engaging in sexual activity and the knowledge and awareness they have for sexual and reproductive health, contraception, and consent?
Right. That is a very important topic that I really think we need to do something, and we need to work. Yeah. The main issue is because of their lack of knowledge. And in terms of sexual education, in general, for the time being, the information that our adolescents get is mainly from the teachers at school, but there's no specific sexual and reproductive module per se. So the sort of topics for sexual and reproductive health is broken into pieces, will be covered in a science subject, for example, will be covered in a moral or subject, pengajian Islam, for example. So it's just bit and pieces. And of course, the literature has shown that the big issue with our Malaysian, because there's a taboo to some people to even mention the word sex is just such a very big word. Mm. And some would refer to, we've talked about sexual intercourse. How would you sort of explain what is sexual intercourse? So some would say hubungan kelamin, or some would say hubungan antara suami dan isteri. But to these youngsters, they've been exposed with the social media materials, and they basically know what sex is. So if we are not transparent enough with them, if the educators are not transparent, they will look for something else, the information from anywhere that would sort of please them. So that would be wrong information. So what I'm trying to get is, Melissa, for the time being, of course, the school is doing whatever that they can, and I'm not promoting or suggesting that they need extra module. But what I am trying to advocate now, what the work that presently I'm trying to push is, we need to empower our parents to talk about sexual education at home. Mm. Sexual education should begin at home. Parents should take the responsibility to teach their own kids about sex. Mm. But what happened in our people, because of these cultural values, this cultural barrier, if parents do talk about sexual health, they don't actually talk about, if the parents talk about sex, they don't talk about sexual health. They talk about the moral, the religious values pertaining to sexual activity. So the do's and the don'ts, right? But how many of the parents really spend really good time to talk about puberty? How many of our parents really explained about pregnancy as soon as the child actually reached puberty or having menses, for example?
How? What do you tell the parents that you speak to? What is the advice that you give them to have these frank and honest and candid conversations? I can imagine it might not be easy for some parents. What is your advice to them?
Yeah, we just need to break that. We need to break the taboo. I know it is a big move, but we just need to break. We need to desensitize our public. S-E-X is sex. Sex is sex. And it's not something that we are talking bad. Our intention is to educate our youngsters to know what they are doing now is actually harming themselves. And I think from the national data is clearly shown 90% of the teens, as they perform the sexuality, 90% perform unsafe sex. They don't use condom, that put them to have sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV, that put them at risk to have unplanned pregnancy. And the number of HIV cases contributed by our youngsters is just like, I think if I'm not mistaken, close to 40%. Wow. So it's a big number. Yeah. For the young HIV cases, less than 29 years old, close to 40%.
Okay. Dr. Azima, can I also ask you, what are the dangers if parents don't have these conversations with their children? What are the dangers of teenagers turning to the internet to get information about sexual and reproductive health?
It's huge, Melissa, it's huge. The dangers is borderless, should I say that? There's no limit. And I mean, we have local data. Once the teens use the social media, there's a risk for sexual grooming. the risk of sexual dating, there's risk for sexual texting, and of course, after that, they would end up with meeting with whatever guy, the anonymous guy, or whoever that they don't really know in detail. They meet outside, and there will be sexual abuse and whatnot. So that is one. Another important thing is they can have wrong information because there's no control over that. And in our current IR 5.0 is basically you get whatever information within seconds. So but we cannot stop technology. That's why I still promote and encourage parents. Yes, we won't stop technology, but parents need to take the responsibility to monitor what sort of sites that their kids are using, are visiting, and there should be specific family rules at home, because in one of my projects, 75% of our youngsters actually declared they have watched pornographic material. 75%, 3 in 4. That's huge. And of course, that pornographic materials would lead to the desire, because during adolescence, they just want to try. So there's no point of knowing but not practicing or not trying to do. So they would try and do. So in one of the cases that I've mentioned before in one of the talk is how this guy, after watching pornographic 200 movies in a day, after that he ended up masturbating himself, then performed sexual activity later. So see how it progresses. So yeah, it's just not safe at all.
It escalates. So the danger of teenagers not having that kind of safe space to talk to parents, or to get information from the right sources, where beyond parents, are there ways that, say, community, peers, schools, or even governments can look at addressing? It's a difficult topic, but it cannot maybe just be left to the household itself, right?
That is right. Well, I do not know if the Malaysian Security Internet can, the Malaysian MCMC, is it? That they can, if they can do something in terms of controlling the information or the certain website, but that is sort of a very Melissa, if it's beyond home, I think if we are talking about government, how can we control that internet? If there's something that we can do to control that, then perhaps something. But if we cannot do that, then we really need to empower our people to be responsible users.
Right.
So to do that, of course, you need to have public health campaigns. The school also need to teach about how to be responsible users. I think that's what I can think now.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to also ask you in the time that we have left to maybe help us understand what are some of the gendered differences when it comes to understanding the trends in adolescent health. Are there significant differences between how young teen girls are compared to young teen boys?
Right. Okay. What I can see is just based on whatever research that I've done and some of the reviews that I've done. So in general, of course, males still predominate in terms of risky behaviors, including sexual activity and as well like smoking and alcohol or illicit drug. Males still predominate, meaning boys. But we are seeing the trend now where the girls are catching up. if you look around, you would see it's quite not uncommon now to see the girls who smoke vapes, for example. So, but yes, there's a difference where boys tend to predominate, and it largely perhaps contributed by the hormonal difference, the androgen hormones, right? And studies have shown that boys tend to be risk takers compared to the girls. But I suppose as the result of gender equality movement, you see sort of the girls trying to catch up, I think.
Okay. Dr. Asima, thank you so much for joining me on the show today, sharing your insights about your work and research. I appreciate your time. That was Associate Professor Dr. Nur Azima Mohamed, Consultant in Family Medicine and Senior Lecturer at the Department of Family Medicine at UKM's Faculty of Medicine. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.